Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
In association with Viatel Technology Group, IT leaders breathe easy with Viatel Managed Cybersecurity. Viatel.com.
This is News Talk.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up over the next hour, we're going to take a closer look at the digital news report published by Commission Naman. Where are people getting their news and should we be worried? We'll ask if AI is going to eradicate discrimination in the workplace. And as ever, I'll answer your tech questions. If you want to get in touch, you can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. Or you'll find me on Instagram at JessKellyNT. But we're going to start with that report published by Commissioner Naman earlier this week. It provides some fascinating insights into the digital news realm, which is massive. Now, it is a global report, but there are aspects that focus in on Ireland. And I'm delighted to say that Stephen O'Leary of Alitigo is with me now to make sense of it. Stephen, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Jess.
It's great to have you on. As I mentioned there, this report was published earlier in the week. There's a whole host of stuff in it. We could do an entire hour on this one report. But I saw that you posted a really interesting take on LinkedIn. And I just wanted to delve a little bit deeper into your own thoughts on it, because the last few times you've been on the show, we've been talking about social media, which is obviously your forte. We've been talking about the changes that have happened on some of the platforms. So with all of that context in mind, what were the things that jumped out at you from this report?
Yeah, so it's the digital news report for 2024. And like you say, it's an incredibly detailed piece of analysis. So it's a joint project between the DCU, Future of Journalism, the University of Oxford, the Reuters Institute, and obviously then Commissioner Naman, who were central to the launch of this and the publication of the material on the day. And like, when I talk about material, this is a 130 page document, and it is incredibly rich. For anybody who is connected or actively has an interest or works in the media in Ireland or has got anything to do with digital news, there's something for everybody, essentially. Mm-hmm. But like you say, the element that Olitico and I were most interested in was that social media angle, because we do know that social media is an increasingly important source of news. And actually, one of the headline findings from the accessing news section of this was, in terms of what is the main source of news for Irish people, there was a marginal increase in social media being listed as the main source, but it's one in five. So 21% of people said that in Ireland, that social media was their main source of news. And, this is a really important point when we think about, that's not just where they get any kind of news, but it's their main source. Mm. And if you think about it, that means that's where they go to first. That's where they're getting the majority of their news. So the idea or the assumption that you can rely on the fact that people will have listened to the radio or watched television or bought a newspaper in order to have gotten their news, that's simply no longer the case. And increasingly now we see these news outlets having very active social profiles and using them to promote the news coverage that they're publishing.
The point that you make there is really interesting and worth picking up on, because I think there'd been this perception that people were tuning out of news, because obviously in the last number of years, between COVID, global unrest, political unrest, it's been quite overwhelming. And I think there had been this narrative that, people don't necessarily want to hear the doom and gloom all of the time, that they're not interested. But maybe it's just that where and when they've accessed it has shifted more so than the interest level.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question, because it is one of the key questions that the report sought to answer. And so the question, how often do Irish people actively avoid the news? That has increased. So the often or sometimes, which is the highest kind of rating, jumped from 34% in 2023 to 44% in 2024. So it is true that people are looking, an increasing number of people are looking to actively avoid news stories. That's simply come through in the data and the analysis. But equally, the question, how interested are Irish people in the news, 20% cited themselves being extremely interested and 34% very interested. So the not at all interested, which is kind of the other end of the scale, was down at 3%. So there's a huge amount to be taken in terms of are Irish people interested in the news? Like, absolutely, that is in no doubt. But that idea of news avoidance, so how often are Irish people saying, God, I just can't take any more of the news? That's seen a big jump, as I say, from 34% in 23 to 44% in 2024.
So let's just talk through some of the headlines, because I have the report here in front of me, and I've scrolled down obviously enough to the Irish page just to see not only the online and social side of things, but also the prominence and the patterns when it comes to digital media or traditional media's online portals. So RT News Online, The Journal, The Independent Online, like people are shifting there as well. Like there is. The move has been made, I do think, from traditional TV, newspaper, radio to the online world, and we are seeing prevalence there as well.
Yeah, so there's a breakdown on a brand basis in terms of traditional sources, but also digital sources. And like you say, RT News Online is top of the list at 25%. In a way, a lot of these figures are relatively unchanged year on year. So there's been minor increases, and some are included for the first time this year. But there's no doubting that these digital sources, and this is a question of like 3 times plus a week, so these are like being frequently checked, do play an increasingly important part. But again, this is all about context. So while online news is very important, the traditional news brands actually, in a lot of cases, have a higher percentage in terms of answering that questions about sources that you check 3 plus times a week. So if you compare, for example, RT News Online at 25%, the RT TV News is up at 33%. So it's traditional is still outperforming or playing a greater role when it comes to the consumption of news. But there's no doubting its importance in the overall mix for where people access their news online. And when you look at the breakdown of the actual overall sector, so if you take it away from a brand and look more broadly at the category, online news is now the single most important source of news for Irish people. It's the main source. So at 33%, it outperforms TV at 31, social at 21, down to radio at 12, and printed newspapers at 3%.
And so again, when we look at the stats, because I do I get that it's a snapshot, right? But I do think it's quite interesting. One that jumped out at me was that overall trust in news is down 7 percentage points since the height of the pandemic. Does social have a role to play in that? Because before, like back in the day, you know, the news was the news was the news. Whereas now everybody has a take on the news, and sources claiming to be news outlets or journalists and so on are given the same sort of megaphone that traditional brands are given. So is social responsible for the trust aspect, do you think?
Yes, it certainly plays a critical role. And again, I think what's very interesting in the analysis are the questions that are posed. So, very helpfully, the report starts at a broader view. So, it actually asks for social media used for any reason. This is one of the questions they pose. So, which, if any, of the following social networks have you used for any purpose in the last week? So, it actually doesn't address news at all. It starts at this really broad site. And I think what's very interesting in this analysis, there's 15 networks listed, and all of them are down with one exception, which is Reddit. And again, at Analytico, it's not a surprise to us, because if we look at where Irish people talk online and the conversations they're having about brands or organizations or topics, Reddit is an ever-increasing network. And there are literally hundreds of Irish-related subreddits from the main Ireland right down to each county, through to specialist topics like personal finance. There's loads of kind of areas where Irish people can now go to ask questions of other Irish people about Irish specific topics. But then they go from the broad and they focus right in on the issue of news. And that paints a slightly different picture of where people are sharing and getting and accessing their news. And much as we look at publicly available information, I guess what's also interesting is to see sort of the more private places where news is being shared. So like WhatsApp, for example, now is up at 22% in terms of where you would have discussed, read, watched, or shared news in the last week. And we've no line of sight, obviously, on anything that gets shared on WhatsApp. It's all private. But this analysis showcases how important that is. And what we do know more broadly is that that is where misinformation and disinformation can get shared and go viral.
I do wonder, have the changes that X, and I've waited this long to bring X into the conversation specifically, but do you think that the changes that happened and also the use by some journalists and some news organizations of the platform has impacted the results of this report, not just in Ireland, but around the world as well? Because I know that there are certain news outlets who don't use it now. I know there are certain journalists who don't use it now because of either like from a taking a stand point of view, or some of the journalists who were using it pretty heavily up until COVID walked away from the platform because of the abuse they were receiving.
Well, it saw the biggest drop in social media used for any reason in response to that question. So in 2023, and it's been in decline. So in 2022, it was up at 27%. In 23, it was at 26. That dropped to 21% in 2024. So there's a real trend line there when it comes to its use for any reason. Now, it's a little different when it comes to news. And the reality is that for better or worse, X is still where breaking news occurs in a way that it doesn't on other networks. It still has that real-time element. And you only need to look at things like the European Championships that are going on at the moment, the upcoming Olympics, the UK general election. It's still where breaking news occurs. But the trend year on year, even in terms of its use for news, is in 2023, that was at 15%. That's dropped to 13% in 2024. And in contrast, other networks have seen a fairly big lift. So Instagram's gone from 15% to 17, YouTube from 19 to 23. So there's lots of other networks that are actually seeing an increase in how its users are using the network for news, whereas X is going in the other direction. So it's certainly not a case that the network is no longer important or not being used or doesn't play a role. And as I say, there isn't a network that competes with it from a real-time news point of view, but there's no doubting that this analysis suggests it's being used less and by fewer people, not just more broadly, but even within the context of a source of news.
I'm really interested to know your take because obviously the work that you do at Analytico has informed us over so many years about, you know, what people are talking about, where, when, and why, and so on. But when you look at this type of report and you look at what's gone on over across the world over the last 18 months alone, do you see a dramatic shift on the horizon, or do you think that the platforms that are there are still going to dominate, just the ratios of popularity might shift slightly?
It's a great question, and it's notoriously hard to predict, right? I think it's very hard to know if there is another new network at the moment bubbling that's about to absolutely explode. But there are markers in the data that do show how quickly newer networks can play a role in informing where people get their news. So again, TikTok is really noticeable here. You go back to 2020, 2% of people said it was where they went to get their news in Ireland. That's gone up to 10% in 2024. So 1 in 10 people in Ireland have, in the following week, used TikTok to get their news or to discuss the news. So again, that's probably a really good illustration, one, of the importance of the network. And again, that would absolutely mirror the analysis that we do of that network more broadly in Ireland. It's obviously not just for news, but in terms of brands using it, how consumers engage, what we discuss, how we talk about it. And it doesn't have the absolute real-time element of X, but it does have a lot of the features. Now, there's a higher barrier because you've got to create video-based content as opposed to just text that you can't just fire off 140 characters and it's there. It is slightly different, but it does play a really important role in real-time information. And increasingly, we see traditional news organizations making excellent use of the network to share what they would have traditionally published on their newspaper or on TV or on their radio station or even on their own website. And now they're creating versions of that content for TikTok. And quite often their TikTok content is outperforming where it would have traditionally sat. So that's probably the standout for us in terms of network shifts, that that's really coming into its own in terms of its importance for news and digital news consumption in Ireland.
I was out at the Docky Book Fest on Sunday and I was on a panel in the afternoon, and it was looking at, I suppose, the impact of social media on democracy, or the media as a whole on democracy, but obviously social media was a big point. But we went down this tangent of talking about business models, because if you're a traditional media outlet, obviously you've had to shift over the last number of years, establishing a website, having social profiles, doing exactly what you said there, you know, not only just tailoring your content for social, but in some instances, reshooting, repurposing and so on. But one of the points that was made is that traditional media companies are still businesses. And at the moment, it feels like they're still being held captive to algorithms that aren't fully transparent, shifts in algorithms that aren't fully transparent, changes like not seeing a link or not being able to post a hyperlink and just without, and not being able to post a headline of an article and so on. Like, the social media companies do hold so much power when it comes to traditional media trying to get their message out there and trying to connect with new audiences as well.
They do. And like, in ways, thus it's ever been when it comes to the social networks and the power and influence that they exert. And there is increasing levels of conversation about that concentration of power and the dangers that poses. And certainly that's a very live topic of conversation, I think, for regulators across the globe. I think on a more maybe sort of positive note for, let's say, traditional or digital news producers in Ireland, particularly maybe when it comes to maybe the online editions, where typically there may not have been as easy a way to monetize the audience, right? So whether that's through decreasing advertising or other kind of challenges, there's a standout statistic in the analysis from this report about whether people will pay for online news content or access paid online pieces. And this, you know, this is critical to the future of journalism, not just in Ireland, but globally. But what's most noticeable is not only is there an increase from 12% in 2020 to 17% in 2024 in response to the question, do you pay for or access paid online news content? But the greatest shift comes in the 18 to 24 year old age bracket. That's up from 19% in 2023 to 26% in 2024. The one in four people, based on this analysis, in Ireland between the ages of 18 and 24, pay for online news. And that suggests that it's a norm that is emerging. And critically, that that cohort placed that type of value on verified, journalist, editor-checked, fact-checked, context-based, nuanced news content. And I think, you know, that would give me huge hope and a degree of confidence that there is a strong future for independent news organizations, not just in Ireland, but more globally. But this statistic here is focused on that Irish market. But if one in four people between the ages of 18 and 24 have paid for or are currently paying for online news, then the market exists, and that should only grow as that age group grows.
Yeah, I took great comfort in that stat for the reasons you just outlined. But I also think that generation, paywalls and paid subscriptions is their norm. The generation that I grew up in and you grew up in was that, you know, we had YouTube for free. We had all of these websites for free because they wanted to get audience in, and then suddenly they realized, actually, we have to make some money. So is there an argument that this is just, it's all they've ever known, and so it makes sense? Or do you like to keep that optimistic take of they see the value in paying for quality, editor checked and so on?
Well, the beauty is, and again, this is like, I mean, there's so much credit here due to the team in DCU, who I know put in months of hard work and research into actually analyzing this data. But because they did, because of all the work done, as I say, by the Reuters Institute, the University of Oxford, and Kamashun Naman, in addition to the team in DCU, we get such granular data, so we can answer the question. So let's just be kind and broadly put us into the 35 to 44 year old window.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yes. Even within that window, it's gone from 14% in 2023 to 19% in 2024. So this isn't exclusive to 18 to 24 year olds. That's where we've seen the biggest jump, and they now account for the largest percentage. But in almost every category, whether that is the overall total, which has gone from 15% to 17%, or any of the age-based categories, it's either flat or it's gone up, with the one exception being the 55 to 64-year-old category. So I think your insight is absolutely right. This is generational, and it doesn't apply to everybody. And the greatest shift is to those, let's say, digitally native audiences who are used to paying for this content from when they start. But it's not exclusive to them. And the confidence I would have and the hope I would have for the industry comes from the fact that it's not just them, but that it's across a broader section, and that increasingly it's becoming more normal and more expected that we will have to pay for high quality journalism, and we're willing to do it.
One of the key phrases along with AI that I've heard this year is that, you know, this is the year of elections. I think it's like half of the population are voting in some form of election this year, which is just bananas. Do you think the use and abuse of technology such as AI on social platforms when it comes to news related content, will that damage news outlets? So, for example, in the context of the Indian election, I know there was an awful lot of talk around deepfakes and AI being utilised to mix messaging, and a bit of it was light-hearted, but obviously things get interpreted different ways by different people. Do you think that there could be further damage done to traditional news outlets, or even new news outlets, as a result of the magnitude and the scale of the news cycle over the next few months?
Yeah, I think so. So there's probably two parts to this. There's the misinformation, disinformation piece, which is on the one hand, and then there's probably the role of AI. Now, there's crossover, right, in that we know AI is being used to create ever increasing volumes of information more generally. And some of that is naturally going to be misinformation or disinformation. But the analysis and the report would suggest that audiences are becoming increasingly aware of misinformation and disinformation, and the media literacy more broadly is improving, so that people are getting better at spotting what would be termed as maybe, let's say, fake news or misinformation or disinformation. And at the very least, they're getting better at questioning it. Now, this is supported by the work of, for example, like The Journal and their fact-checking service and a range of other news outlets who do a really good job of questioning some of these stories as they emerge and really sort of like putting out fires to an extent when it comes to stopping in the tracks the spread of misinformation or disinformation. But then on the other side, you do have that question of AI, and we know for better or worse that it is going to play an increasing role in news production. And the question was asked, what topics are Irish people less comfortable with when it comes to using AI in news production? And it is really interesting to your point about the elections, that the most popular topic, or the topic that ranks at the top of that list in terms of being less comfortable, is politics. So 54% of people said they were less comfortable when it comes to using AI in the news production of political content. But, you know, local news, crime, business all feature in there too. But, you know, at the bottom of the list is celebrity or entertainment news. So I think there's this feeling that, like, if you want to automate a little bit of our pop culture content, go right ahead. You know, like, there's maybe less of a risk there. But when it comes to politics, we need to have much more journalistic oversight, and we can't rely on simply a bot or an algorithm or AI to just generate content for us on a topic. There needs to be the scrutiny of and the skills of journalists, editors, and news producers more broadly.
So you've talked us through many of the key findings. I suppose if someone wanted a bluffer's guide to the analysis of this report, how would you sum it up? If someone's in the pub tonight and they want to just say that they've read it, they're across it and all the rest, what is the easiest way to interpret, digest and regurgitate the key takeaways of this report?
I think there's probably three that you can probably hone in on, right? So there is a level of awareness that there is misinformation and disinformation, and that the increasing role of social networks poses challenges there, right? So audiences need to be on the watch out and need to question the news that they are being served, regardless of where it's coming from. However, trust in traditional news outlets would appear to be very strong. And actually, in fact, the emergence of AI and some of these things around misinformation and disinformation means that there's a greater reliance now on traditional news outlets for the quality of journalism that they are producing. But the standout for me is around that paid question, because ultimately the future, like, you know, it's not a voluntary position, right? This is not something where we can just rely on the goodwill of, you know, publicly funded journalism for the rest of our lives. There has to be a commercial model that works. And I think the thing that is the standout piece here is that 17% of Irish people now pay for access to online news, and where you're seeing the greatest growth is in that 18 to 24 year old cohort. So the youngest in our society who are able to pay for news are not just paying for it, but they're paying for it in ever increasing numbers. And I think that's a really positive sign for the future of journalism in Ireland and the media in Ireland, but also that the public more broadly value it and are willing not just to place a value on it, but put euros up.
Awesome stuff. Stephen O'Leary of Alitigo, as ever, thank you so much for joining us here on News Talk.
Thanks, Jess.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Thank you so much for joining us. There is a reported school shooting in Connecticut. And I said, they are going to come after our guns, look for mass shootings. And then magically it happens. This is staged.
That's when our world turned upside down again.
Alex Jones is the most polarizing figure in this nation.
It's hard being a white person.
InfoWars was thought of as a fringe organization, but at its height, more people were watching than CNN.
Unlike the troll media, I try to tell the truth. The government will not tell you that during increased radiation levels, you need more iodine.
He turned some story into a need for a supplement.
You got parents method acting, the green screens and the lies. It's not real.
What do you mean this didn't happen?
It started less than 48 hours after the shooting, and then it grew exponentially.
We need to analyze all these videos now.
Emails, letters threatening us.
It was a contagion spreading to billions of people, and it was only getting worse.
And that's when I filed the lawsuit against Alex Jones.
This is a show trial.
The most egregious case of defamation in American history.
75 million people believe that Sandy Hook was saved.
I believe they're being fed and manipulated.
You believe everything you say is true, but it isn't.
Let's talk about InfoWars' business model.
You put out a story, it gets people's attention.
Go to InfoWarsStore.com.
InfoWars is actually an infomercial, right?
These families have been hunted, and Jones is getting rich off it. It's just so obvious what they're doing.
That's how he runs his empire, and that needs to be stopped.
You must tell the truth while you testify.
I believe I told the truth. This is a kangaroo court. This is a political action. It's a witch hunt.
This is not your show. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury have reached a verdict.
I hope to accomplish an era of truth. Please.
Yeah, that is a snippet from The Truth versus Alex Jones, which is a new documentary from HBO that takes a closer look at the defamation action taken by the parents of the Sandy Hook victims against broadcaster Alex Jones. I watched it on Tuesday night, and I have to say it's an upsetting watch at times, but I do think it's an important one. It shows the human impact of false statements, particularly from very high profile figures such as Alex Jones. I would really recommend it, but do brace yourself, because there are certain parts where you're hearing from parents talking about their children who died. Explain the impact of hearing Alex Jones say that it was all a hoax, and hearing the threats and abuse that they received as a result of people listening to Alex Jones. So do brace yourself for an upsetting, slightly uncomfortable watch, but it's utterly compelling. It's yeah, definitely the best thing I watched this week. As ever, if you've any recommendations for me, you can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. But we are going to turn our attention now to the issue of artificial intelligence. What a shock. But a different take on it. So a lot of the conversations in the last little while have related to how disruptive it's going to be, as if this has just come out of nowhere at all overnight. But that's not the case, because one area in which the technology has been used for quite a while now is HR. But is that going to change? I'm joined now by Linda Hines from Lewis Silkin. Linda, you're very welcome to the show. We've been hearing so much about AI in pretty much every aspect of our lives. But one area in which it's already being utilised, and it has been for a while, is in the area of HR and particularly recruitment. For those who don't work in this realm, can you just detail how, when and why it is being utilised?
Well, so I think it's probably been around for a while, and it's interesting. It's such a hot topic now. But if you think about, you know, a lot of employers and companies are using AI tools, particularly in the recruitment and selection areas to help them sift through massive numbers of applications and help them manage those recruitment processes. So we are seeing it used a lot in that area, and that's something that's been around for a while. So I suppose that's not new. What is new is the regulators now trying to catch up with all of the technology that's constantly emerging. And it's important for employers who already have AI tools deployed in their organizations who are looking into deploying them to understand what the regulatory framework is and to try and audit what they're already using to see how is it going to fit into this new regulatory framework.
Yeah, that is the important thing, because there's no shortage of AI tools that are incredibly useful, and there's no doubt that if we all embrace them fully, we would save a huge amount of time. But the AI doesn't know what's right and what's wrong from a regulatory point of view, from an ethical point of view. It's one of the big issues with this technology. So can you just explain, like maybe give some examples of what would not be allowed in terms of the regulations?
And I think it's important for employers certainly to sit down and look at the EU AI Act. So that's really what we're talking about. That's the big piece. It's been described in some areas as GDPR on steroids in terms of the potential impact of it. But there are, so the EU AI Act looks at all the different scenarios in which AI may be used within an organization, and it categorizes them basically according to risk. So you have some situations where that risk is just unacceptable and that use is prohibited under the AI Act. I would expect that for most HR systems or AI use in the workplace, that's going to fall under the high risk category under the EU AI Act. And so that is AI systems that negatively affect safety or fundamental rights. And those are considered high risk. And in the actual guidance itself around the regulation, it gives specific examples of HR type use cases that may be considered high risk. So while they're not necessarily going to be prohibited, there will be further obligations applying in relation to deploying those AI tools within your organization. And again, I think it's critical to point out that some of those AI tools may already be in your organization. So you're now trying to ensure that you do an inventory to see what are we actually using. Do any of them fall under these high risk systems that are going to be set out in the legislation? And what do we need to do in order to comply with that?
Yeah, one thing that I'm curious about, obviously I don't work in HR, but I just wonder, when it comes to AI, technology that isn't great at explaining itself, will the book stop with the HR manager or the CTO to go back to candidates who feel that they perhaps were discriminated against in some capacity to then investigate the AI to ensure that there are no biases or there's no, you know, fundamental discounting of people, maybe because of their name or their race or their gender or their age and so on?
And I think this is going to be the challenge for HR managers and for employers, is they're not necessarily going to understand why the AI tool has reached a certain decision. And there's different types of discrimination under the Irish employment legislation. So you have direct discrimination, you have indirect discrimination. And you could see how, as you said, the AI tools are built on, a lot of them are built on data that's already there, or they're learning from historical examples within an organization. So if the underlying information that that tool is learning on has some element of bias or discrimination, those tools are going to potentially and, you know, naturally replicate that bias without even recognizing that there is a bias or that they're doing it. And if there is a case around, let's say, someone saying they don't think their selection process for a role was fair or was discriminatory, they will be able to seek information on what decisions were made. And the challenge for employers is going to be, how can you explain some of the underlying, I suppose, technology that's actually making those decisions? And it is for the employer to rebut the presumption that the person has been discriminated against. So all in a candidate would have to show is that there's potential that they've been discriminated against. And then the burden of proof flips to the employer to show, well, actually, no, there is a non-discriminatory reason for the decision that was made. I could see cases before the Workplace Relations Commission becoming very difficult in that regard, where the decisions have been made using AI technology, and it could be very difficult to explain what the basis for that decision is, or to prove that there is no discrimination. So yeah, there's no easy answer around it. I think that's the challenge. And I think it's going to be important that people are trained on the potential for bias and discrimination within the tools, so that potentially they can try and recognize it, and also that there is a fail-safe where there is an element of human intervention, so that in the event of challenge, there is a human decision that the employer can stand over.
Yeah, like I can envisage a whole ton of issues. And I suppose the onus goes back to the company from the very outset. And even if software is in place today, they need to assess the integrity of any platform that they're utilizing and ensure that the data that it's working off is, you know, comprehensive, fair, as accurate as possible, and as without as many biases as possible.
And it's important to remember, so the EU AI Act isn't necessarily about an employee claiming that their employer has discriminated against them. That will come under the equality legislation that we already have. And the equality legislation is not designed with AI, use of AI technology in mind. And that's where the challenge is, because there's a lot of obligations under the EU AI Act, but employers also have obligations under lots of different pieces of employment legislation, and they could be inadvertently breaching those other pieces of legislation by the way that they deploy and use these AI tools in the HR context. So, you know, discrimination falls under the equality legislation. Mm-hmm. That's a separate piece of legislation to the EU AI Act. So there needs to be a holistic consideration of what are all the risks for an organization in terms of deploying these tools.
And just like let's imagine that we do end up where there is a case brought. Like, is it enough for a company to say it's not us, it's the robot?
No. Ultimately, if say it's an employment equality case where an employee or a candidate for a role is saying that they have been discriminated, the ultimate liability will rest with the employer, and the ultimate burden of proof, so the actual, the decision will have to be explained by the employer, because ultimately they have used that tool to implement that decision. So ultimately it is the employer's decision in terms of the equality legislation. You won't be adding in the original developer of the AI tool in terms of your employment equality claim. So it is really important for employers and HR managers to think about all of the risks with implementing these tools. Because I think there is, of course, there is huge benefits, and that can't be, you know, can't be stressed enough in terms of the benefits, but it's being careful that you know exactly what your use case is for these tools, and that you have risk assessed and tried to mitigate those risks. And there are certain scenarios where you will need to ensure that you have done your due diligence with the provider that you're getting the tool from to try and ensure that there's as limited bias as possible. But ultimately, you do need to be mindful that from an employment law context, the risk will ultimately rest with the employer.
Mm. You alluded to it earlier on, but I think this one example can kind of put some minds at ease, because a lot of the conversations around AI have been, you know, related to the fact that it's going to replace all of us and you know, humans won't be necessary. That thing of human in the loop in this context seems utterly important and vital, in fact.
Yes, and I think really what it's going to mean is it's a shift, I suppose, in what the roles are going forward. So I do think there is a lot of scaremongering around AI is going to, none of us will have jobs anymore. But I think it's just about becoming aware of how AI can support you and where you need to also be able to use those AI tools properly. So, you know, potentially it will mean human intervention is more around the strategic decisions than, say, that the pure data processing. So our roles will change, and our roles may develop to ensure that we can prompt and use AI appropriately, whereas that wasn't necessarily part of our roles before. So I think there's huge opportunities and benefits that could come out of the deployment of AI in the HR context. But I think knowledge is key here. And understand, not just deploying a tool without properly understanding it and risk assessing it and making sure you're using it for the appropriate use case, and that your employees who are using it know what the limits are around what they should be doing with it.
Brilliant advice there. Linda Hines, thank you so much for joining us here on News Talk.
Thanks, Jess.
Tech Talk with Jess Kelly.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up in just a few minutes' time here on News Talk, John Fardy will be in with Screen Time. But before we get to that, I want to have a quick look at the inbox. As ever, if you've got any questions for me, you can drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. I have one here from James. He says, "Hi, I have a Samsung S22 for nearly 2 years now, and I'm due an upgrade, but I don't want to pay €80 a month. I'm thinking of doing pay-as-you-go for €35 and keeping my current phone. My phone is in great condition, but the battery life is becoming an issue. Is it possible to buy an authentic Samsung battery? I Googled it and only dodgy-looking websites came up. Your advice would be greatly appreciated." So James, this is all music to my ears. Every single element of this is great. I think you're absolutely right to move away from paying €80 a month for a phone bill. That to me is just bananas. The pay-as-you-go option sounds great at €35, but if you wanted to save even more money, I'd recommend GOMO. I know I spoke about it in this very segment a few weeks back, but GOMO is $14.99 a month. Which is a significant saving on €35 a month. And it's great. You get all calls, texts and data. It's 5G enabled as well, so you've got great coverage, great speeds. It's just a no-brainer. Also, it is a rolling contract, a 30-day rolling contract, so you don't have to worry about topping up as you would with a pay-as-you-go account. It's just another suggestion for you. When it comes to the battery, I think you're absolutely right, firstly, to keep your phone. If there's nothing wrong with it, there's no need to upgrade. It's not a massive update in terms of features from the S22 anyway. But when it comes to getting an authentic battery, get on to, there are Samsung stores here in Ireland. I don't know where in the country you're based, it doesn't say, but there is one in Dundrum Town Centre in Dublin. I know that for sure because I walked by it the other day. You can also get onto reputable repair stores. So Back from the Future is definitely one. They can get authentic parts. You do absolutely, you're so right to look for the authentic parts. I would also recommend you go to somewhere that can fit it for you, because it's just going to be less problematic for you. So check out Back from the Future or indeed the Samsung stores. If you've no joy with that, get on to me again. And what I'll do is I'll get on to Samsung and ask for their recommendation. But my big point here would be consider GOMO. Move away from the €80 phone bill. It's just madness. Next, we have one from April. She says, "Hi, Jess. I'm entitled to a company phone when I start my new job. Just wondering if you can recommend the best Android. Need an excellent camera for social media posts and ideally something with a nice large screen. Okay, April, firstly, congratulations on the new gig. I hope it goes well for you. In terms of the best Android phone, I would have to say it's the Google Pixel 8. And if you want the biggest screen possible and the best phone possible, go for the Google Pixel 8 Pro. It is phenomenal. One of my friends has it, and every time I see pictures from it, I'm just blown away by the clarity. When I tested it, I was really struck by how quick it is. There's a whole host of AI features that are built into this device that are so useful. Like things from, you know, transcribing minutes of a meeting to the blur thing, Magic Eraser, that's the one. The Magic Eraser on Google Photos to make your images look great. So say, for example, you're taking a photograph of me, but there's a bin behind me. You can just circle the bin using Magic Eraser and it's gone. So I would definitely say the Google Pixel 8 Pro is the best Android phone, and I would highly recommend it. So I hope that helps. If you do have any questions, as I said, I'm always happy to answer as many as I can. Drop me an email to techtalk@newstalk.com. But that's it from me this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full on the News Talk app powered by Go Loud. I'll be back with Shane and Kira on Monday's News Talk Breakfast. But in the meantime, have a great weekend.